behind the screen. There's a world of pure imagination behind the screen.
Hey everybody, we took a week off this week on the Paul Goebel Show, but I still wanted to put a show up, so I thought many of you have heard us talk about Jim and Tom's old podcast, Stealing God, which never quite got off the ground due to their complete lack of technical savvy. So I thought I would play you an old episode they did so you could see what it was like. It's a pretty interesting podcast. I hope you enjoy it, and thanks for listening. See you next week.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 2 of Stealing God. I'm your host, Jim Bruce, and of course with me is co-host Tom Griffin.
Hello.
So this is a thought, since it's only the second episode, we'll tackle a very minor subject of modest controversy. We'll just talk about abortion this time. Because that's never trouble, right? Right?
Right.
Okay. I've been wanting to talk about, one of the reasons why I decided that I wanted to do a show in at all was to talk about things like this. And really, most of the things that I talk about are going to come from a particular perspective that we touched on in the pilot episode, which is that I really do find it annoying sometimes in these debates how one position is supposed to cede the concept of moral high ground. One position is the moral high ground. The other position has to argue from a completely intellectual standpoint, or at least that's how people handle the arguments, when the truth is like Tom and I talked about before, both people can have a moral position even if they are on polar opposites of what they think right and wrong are. Right? We covered that a little bit.
I think we touched on that.
Yeah. What made me decide that I wanted to do this particular topic now was because Billy Graham's son recently made news. Now, Billy Graham, to me, he's, of all the televangelists, I don't know if you'd even consider him a televangelist. I don't think he actually does TV, per se. He has done TV. But of all of them, he seems like the closest to sincere. I've always kind of had a soft spot for Billy Graham in that I think he means well, whereas I don't think Pat Robertson means well. And I don't think a lot of those guys mean well. I think most of them are tools. I think Billy Graham can be a tool sometimes, but a sincere tool. And in that regard, we can all be tools sometimes. What's your general opinion of Billy Graham, just to start there?
I don't really have one.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I think that says something, because you have an opinion about Pat Robertson, right?
Yeah.
And
it's not necessarily favorable.
Yeah, and in general, I do think that speaks well of Billy Graham, because really what he's done mostly is work to spread the message as he sees it, and giving advice to presidents is well recognized as somebody that presidents have turned to. I think like 7 presidents in a row or something. And that this would be the first president he's not an advisor to, because he's more or less retiring, being that he's in his 80s and his sight is failing and all of those kind of things. He's facing different challenges. Now, what's interesting is his son appears to have taken up the baton as a militant evangelical. So he's going to be more, it seems like he's more in the lines of like Pat Robertson. I hope I'm wrong, but it seems like that's who he is. But Billy Graham's son said something very interesting about the subject of abortion recently. And it seemed like he was momentarily being accidentally really honest about the subject in the Bible. Because what he said was, he's praying for Obama. Like he hopes Obama will be a good president, but Obama's position on abortion he doesn't agree with, because he says, because I think the Bible is very clearly that abortion is wrong. And I liked what he said, because he said, I think that the Bible is very clear on that. He did not say what people mostly say, which is that the Bible is empirical. They say it in a way that implies that it is empirical. And I sort of appreciated that, and I also thought that was probably an accident. So I've asked Tom to do a quick little bit of research for me, and he's going to read a few passages from the Bible. And what I'm going to have Tom read from you is Tom is going to read all the passages in the Bible that specifically address and condemn abortion. Tom, take it away.
All right. It looks like this is Exodus 21:22 here.
Actually, that one's for me to read. I want you to read all the verses that specifically condemn abortion.
Okay, so above that?
Yeah.
Okay, that looks like that's nothing.
Right.
Okay, that's...
Good job.
Nothing, yeah.
Nothing.
Okay.
And that is absolutely a strange fact about abortion and the Bible. And what I consider something of a dishonest bit of argumentation on people who defend the Bible, or not defend the Bible, but rather defend the position that the Bible is against abortion, because the Bible never mentions abortion, not once. It just doesn't.
What about twice?
Oh, twice it does, yes. Okay. No, the Bible never mentions abortion. What's interesting to me is that Christians... And I shouldn't say Christians, because I know that that seems like I'm saying this about all Christians. And really, I guess Christian apologists will say that the Bible clearly states that abortion is wrong. And the strength of their argument seems to be that they're always arguing with people who aren't really familiar with the Bible. So they seem to be pulling a fast one, but it seems really dishonest to me. Because what seems dishonest to me is that you're counting on the other person not knowing. You're just, to me, it's like kind of a shell game, and just kind of saying, well, this guy, he's not a Christian, so he probably doesn't read the Bible. So I can just say, well, the Bible is against abortion. And on a national stage, on TV, that's how far the argument always seems to go.
Yeah.
Like, you won't see people challenge that assertion, and I find that really strange, I guess, is one of my big problems with it. And I would also say that the Bible, in my opinion, is closest to being pro-abortion. And that's one of the topics I want to talk about. And then, again, neither one of us are Christians, and neither one of us are very religious, so we'll see how far this goes. But I find it fascinating. When people argue that the Bible is against abortion, one of the... Well, I'll tell Tom, and Tom, you tell me what you think. This is one of the things people will say. They'll say, well, hey, thou shalt not kill, or thou shalt not murder. Mm-hmm. And that is an argument people will say that means that the Bible's against abortion.
Okay.
What are your thoughts on that particular argument?
Well, on that particular argument, I think that the wiggle room there is in how you define killing, because not everybody would necessarily... agree that an abortion involves an actual killing of an actual viable being.
Yeah. And also, I should clarify that in the Hebrew actually does mean murder. Thou shalt not murder. It's because, like, killing, it's because obviously all killing is not off the table. You just have to read the Bible to know that not all killing is off the table. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's really the crux of where a lot of people separate on the issue, obviously, is... Are you terminating an actual human life or any kind of life? Is it a viable being on its own?
Yeah.
And medically, there's a point at which you can definitely say no.
Yeah.
But medically is not necessarily the rubric by which some people would wish to judge.
Yeah. And, you know, I want to say, too, I want to say that if a person... is against abortion for a series of ethical reasons, I think those are valid. I do think that they're valid. I just don't think that the biblical argument, and that's what I'm going to focus on for a little while in this episode.
Yes, certainly. If the biblical argument is thou shalt not kill, that's at best, incomplete argument.
Yeah.
Because then you still have to justify why that's a bad kill.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. You have to draw a line. It's an incomplete argument. It's your premises are not, you haven't fulfilled.
Yeah.
You have one to another. You've skipped some steps.
Yeah. It's like you've laid down, okay, so if you can't If it's a geometry problem, you've laid down your basic law, but you haven't shown how that rule gets you to the next rule, to the next rule, to the next rule, which fulfills this condition.
Yeah. Now, one of the things people will also say is they will say, they'll use King David as an example. I believe it's David, and forgive me if I'm, forgive me, Father, if I'm wrong, but I believe that I'm correct, is that one of the things that in Isaiah, there are verses that talk about, and not just in Isaiah, but they're in different parts of the Bible where they talk about God's pre-knowledge of people, and I knew you in the womb, and particularly with David, I knew you when, before you were born, I knew you, and they'll say, see, that proves God knew you before, before you were born, which proves that he meant for you to exist even in the womb. Is that, that's one of the arguments people will use, and I consider that a weak argument. And the thing I've always said is that those are specific cases where God says he knew David. That doesn't mean he knew me. It really, I think, speaks to a special relationship, because David clearly had a special relationship with God compared to anybody else, really. David is in some ways even more special than, say, Moses. I mean, David occupies such a specific place in Hebrew lore.
It's also still not very specific. I knew you in the womb. Well, are we talking third trimester here?
Right.
You know? Or if you believe in certain metaphysical beliefs, did he know you even before the womb?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Has God known you eternally?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not... It doesn't point to a identifiable principle.
Yeah, this is a little sidetracked, but every now and then, one of the first reasons I got up in arms about this particular issue is, as everybody who has an email account, you'll just get nonsense that people forward you. And there's a forward you'll get from people who, it's a hypothetical that'll say, would you recommend an abortion in these 7 circumstances? I don't know. Have you ever gotten that email?
I can't recall if I've gotten it personally, but certainly I'm familiar with it.
So you're familiar with it. So what it does is it, and I'm sure many of you who I imagine are listening will know that basically the email goes like this. Is like, would you recommend an abortion in the case where this person had this particular birth defect, blah, blah, blah. Well, if you did, you've killed Beethoven. And then all the list of this. And then the last one is, you know, unmarried couple, young, no prospects, no home. Oh, you just killed Jesus. And that's their, you know, supposed to like make you go, wow, you're right. Who knows who the next person could have been? My funny response is always, well, would you recommend an abortion for a kid whose German dad did this? And well, if you didn't recommend an abortion, good job, you gave birth to Hitler. Because it's a silly argument. It's a silly thing to say. And then what I also say is, if God intended somebody to be born, they will be.
Yeah, the emotional manipulation involved is a little disingenuous, especially when you get to the you just aborted Jesus example, because if you think God's got a plan, part of that plan surely has to be Jesus not being aborted.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. And that
if the plan is... is that,
and in fact,
fallible? Then he wasn't paying much attention.
In fact, didn't he prevent an abortion? It just occurred to me. It just dawned on me. Wasn't Herod trying to kill him?
Yeah,
and that was prevented because no, we're not going to let Herod do that. Herod tried to get him later too, when he was like 2 or something, and that was prevented. So clearly, if God intends, so you know, if you got aborted, maybe that's what God wanted. Not to be too glib, and I know, but still, seriously, if God has an intention, he's God. Now, I also say, and I do genuinely say this, that the Bible can be argued to be pro-choice. I shouldn't say pro-abortion, because there's a difference between being pro-choice and pro-abortion. As my friend Paul would say, I don't know anybody who's actually pro-abortion. Don't know anybody who actually advocates abortion. That's a strange position to take. Because even people who are pro-choice recognize that it's an unfortunate choice. that it's not a pleasant circumstance to find yourself in. But this is where I'm going to go straight to the Bible. There are no references to abortion in the Bible. There is only one reference that can be construed as even being truly related to being not much of a tangent. And it's in Exodus, and I say it's a pro-choice verse. Here's what the verse is. It's Exodus 21:22, if anybody wants to look it up. I'm going to be reading from the King James Version, and then I'll also be talking about the New International Version. If men strive and have a conflict and hurt a woman with child so that her fruit depart from her and yet no mischief follow, he shall be surely punished according as the woman's husband will lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. And if any mischief follow, then thou shalt give life for life. Now, this is how this verse has commonly been understood, and it seems pretty clear-cut to me, but I understand it's informed by some of my perspective. If men strive and hurt a woman with child so that her fruit depart from her, her fruit, of course, would be the unborn child. And if it by depart, we mean a miscarriage. The child has died. There is no more baby. And yet no mischief follow. The woman survives. He shall be surely punished according as the woman's husband will lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. He will pay a fine, a monetary compensation to the husband. In, of course, because the woman has no rights at this point in society, or not less rights. So in this particular verse, the death of the fetus is treated different than the death of the woman. It is treated as an issue of tort. It is property. And as property, I think that makes a good case for choice. Because if it's your property, if it's not a person, we're not treating it as a person, I believe it makes a good case for choice. Tom, initial thoughts?
I could see reading it that way. And it certainly doesn't make a strong case for the other. It certainly doesn't make a strong case for the fetus being imparted the same rights or weight as the adult in the situation.
And here we have the one instance in the Bible where we're actually dealing with the killing of a fetus through violence. Now, in this case, it's unintended. So, take it with a grain of salt, because we're not talking about intentionally killing a fetus, although that's done later and for different reasons, but for righteous reasons later in the Bible, that does happen, but I'm not even going to bring that up. But this is the only time when we can say, person causes the death of a fetus, how should they be punished in this case? And it's an issue of tort. So you'd agree with that's a fair interpretation that I'm saying. I don't think I'm going crazy out on a limb. Now, I didn't make that up. I'm not some genius who happened upon this verse, and nobody's ever thought of that before. This is the understanding people have had for decades of this verse. This is how people have understood it in Hebrew, and people have understood her fruit departing from her to be the death of the fetus. Now, in recent years, and I want to go to the New International Version, in the New International Version, her fruit depart from her has been translated rather as, it's translated as premature birth, and she gives birth prematurely. And then in the notes on it, it says, or a miscarriage. But it's interesting to me because that's, again, what I say is I'm like, really? You're going to try to argue that what the people in Hebrew, that what they meant was it was a premature birth. It was a preemie. That's what they tried to make it into a preemie. So the baby survived, but it was a preemie. And so what I say to that, first of all, do you think that even makes sense? To imagine that what that meant, right, that her fruit depart from her meant simply departed the womb. Does that seem fair to you as a fair interpretation of that verse?
No.
Okay. And by the way, we really haven't talked about this ahead of time because I don't want to do that for most of the shows. Because I want Tom to be the voice of reason because, you know, I'm never going to be that in most cases.
Yeah, that certainly not the sense I would get from that, reading that.
Now, here's the other thing I want to say to anybody who suspects, well, maybe it does mean a preemie. I'm going to go on record as saying 4,000, 5,000 years ago, they didn't have preemies. And it wasn't, whatever preemies they had weren't significant enough to make law regarding, because preemies require a lot of machines to survive.
Yeah, that's an excellent point.
And I always find, you putting it in context, what you have to understand, I think, about the laws is that there are specific general laws, but there are a lot of laws that seem to be developed in the same way that we develop laws for ourselves, for our society, which is a circumstance arises. Like, for example, right now in California, there's a debate going on about passing a law to protect Good Samaritans. Because was a case where a guy pulled a woman out of a car that was possibly going to drown. And in his zeal to pull her out, she was paralyzed. And she's suing him. And the courts ruled that, yeah, she has the right to sue him, even though his intention was to save her life. Well, nobody would ever imagine the circumstance where you would need to do that, but the circumstance has arisen, and so now we're considering legislature to pass a law to protect Good Samaritans who are acting in good faith to help their fellow human being. A lot of the biblical laws seem to be written to cover a general theory of law, but some of them are covering specific circumstances, like this one. This law pertains to two dudes are in a fight. One dude accidentally hits a pregnant woman. She either miscarries or has a preemie, but it's covering a specific circumstance. Another is, there really is a verse in the Bible that talks about this, is that two men are in a fight and the wife of one of the men strikes the other man in the testicles. That's really in the Bible. And they determine that the law is she's going to have her hands cut off. Which I say is a solid law, should still be on the books, because you don't hit a guy in the nuts. So what I'm saying is, it doesn't even make sense to me to imagine that they needed a law to say, well, what do we do in case of a preemie? Because you don't have preemies. That doesn't happen without the medical technology to allow the child to survive.
Yeah, any significantly premature child would not survive. It would die soon after birth, and the effect would be the same.
Yeah, exactly. And how many, goodness knows how many babies who were born after the right amount of time in the old days died young, just because, you know, one of the things you would argue with be fruitful and multiply is, yeah, have as many kids as you can, because
the survival rate wasn't...
Yeah, the survival rate is low, and as a species, we need them. And now, at the same time, it just occurs to me that I'm making an argument from a completely heady position and not a position of faith. And, of course, the position of faith could be, of course, well, God knew the future. And I understand that, but I just think that the fair reading of her fruit depart from her implies death. And even in the New International Version, they're forced to, in the notes, say, or miscarriage. So they don't even help themselves, because they say, born prematurely or miscarriage. Well, then you're still saying it died in one case and one not in the law.
Yeah. And if... It's an interesting case, because if the child was born prematurely, but not so prematurely as to be a medical complication, why are we discussing it?
Right.
You know. So, it seems even still, we must be talking about premature enough that the child did not survive.
Yeah, exactly. What is the man paying a fine for?
Yeah.
Because she didn't get the joy of being pregnant a little while longer? Because there's no, like, financial hardship.
Because in that case, if it didn't cause a significant enough complication to be a danger for the child, then you're really just talking about someone hitting another person.
Right.
And the child's not even really part of the argument, is incidental to the argument.
True. And as a matter of tort, if the child dies, we can see why the husband is paid money. He lost a farmer. He lost a member of his clan. He lost a whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And getting back to the moral ground, I think that's well covered, right? from a.
I hope so.
Yeah, and anybody who wants to email me, of course, please do email me. Boy, I didn't set up an email yet, but why don't you email me? I'm stupid, right?
Fairly.
Yeah.
I'll just make one up, and you can set it up after the show.
All right. Why don't you email me at jim@stealinggod.com, right? Because I can set that up, right?
Sure.
Okay, there you go. jim@stealinggod.com. That's fine. Now, putting the Bible aside for a moment and getting back to the core of it is that I say pro-choice is a moral position. It's not the only moral position, but pro-choice is a moral position because for you to pass a law limiting a woman's right to choose means that you have to kind of willfully ignore history or pretend that history doesn't repeat itself. And we already know what happens in a world where women can't legally get abortions, which is in desperate circumstances, like say they have an abusive husband, or say they got pregnant via rape, or say they just don't want to be pregnant, they end up bleeding to death in alleys. That abortions are unfortunately going to be necessary for some women. That the moral position is A, to keep it legal, and possibly to work to rectify those social situations that lead to abortions and to cut down on them that way. And it's worth noting that the percentage of people actually having abortions is on the decline anyway, which I think is a testament to the fact that women have more rights. More rights equates to more options. And when you have more options, abortion maybe drops down on your list of choices.
Yeah, it's almost always an act of desperation, whether or not you feel it's justified, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you're put in a position that you don't feel you can handle or don't feel you should have to for whatever reason. You know, and if you have... Like you said, if you have more choices, then you can make more choices.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, and also I would also argue that it's a moral position from the standpoint of allowing someone their individual rights, not forcing your view on someone, not making someone's choices for them, not taking away someone's right to self-determination.
It also seems pretty Christian to me. Now, one of the reasons I think it's pretty Christian, and I've always thought this, is that if it's a given that no one gets to the Father except through the Son, but you're given the choice, you're already, by Christianity, you're already given the most significant choice by Christian theology, which is to accept Jesus or not. And the outcome of not accepting Jesus, according to the theology, is as dire as anything you can imagine. And yet, the notion that you got to make that choice is considered the most important part.
Yeah, this is something that seems to get lost a lot of times in these more fundamental views, is that choice is supposed to be part of the equation. Free will is supposed to be part of the equation.
Yeah.
We're supposed to believe that God gave us the capability to make that choice and that he wants us to make that choice.
For good or ill.
And you're not supposed to make people's choices for them.
Yeah.
And you're not, you know, people think they have to legislate their beliefs because people are supposed to believe or live the way they say they're supposed to live.
Yeah.
But you're not helping people that way. You're not getting anyone into heaven by taking their choices away.
Right.
They're not making the choices themselves. They're not learning anything.
Yeah.
It's not sincere. It's not faith at that point, unless they come to it on their own.
Yeah, in fact, I don't think they would get into heaven at that point, right?
No.
Not for that.
Not, presumably not, no.
Especially since, according to Christian theology, it's not just deed.
It's important. It's important to leave people that choice.
Yeah.
To let people make their own choices.
And I
know that the argument in this particular case, if you believe that fetus is a life, that fetus doesn't have a choice in that moment. I know that there are people that would argue that. But I don't think that supersedes the fact that the mother does.
Right. And in fact, I think what you have there, because I think there is something to that argument, but what I say, and have said for a while, is unfortunately, you cannot construct the law to protect both choices.
Right.
If you believe that the fetus has a right to a choice, the mom has a right to a choice, well, you can't protect both. You have to protect one, and the one who has achieved personhood, the one who is a part of society, society is obliged to protect. The mother is part of society, already is not coming into being. And, you know, I've heard the argument from very intelligent people, and I understand that what's the difference between a fetus and a baby, and why do you draw such an arbitrary line? I object to the word arbitrary, because it's not arbitrary, because there are lines of distinction for every moment of our life, and with each moment of our life, we get more and more rights, and we are treated differently under the law. You know, when you are a fetus, you have very few rights. You're not really protected, really. Become a baby, you're immediately protected, but there are some rights you don't have. You can't become an emancipated baby, but you can become an emancipated child, because once you become a child, wherever that age is, you can. Teenagers have more rights. Suddenly you can drive. 21-year-old, you have more rights. And you get old enough, you get discounts on meals. That's the deal. Every age is treated different because every age is different and makes different demands on you and creates different demands on society. So, you know, I do think there are moral arguments to why abortion is a bad idea. Or not. I don't want to say a bad idea. There are arguments you could say that it's an immoral choice, but there are arguments to say that it's not. And that's why you leave it to the individual.
And I would think that, you know, as I mentioned in the previous episode, I personally prefer to think of in terms of ethics than morality.
Sure.
Because morality, when you talk about morality, you tend to talk about black and white. Something's either moral or it's not moral. That there's an objective standard that everything. You just look up in the column and see abortion, yes, no, you know. But
right.
When you talk about ethics, you're talking about principles and weighing different principles. And that's what we're talking about in a case like this. You know, there are principles where you say you want to say you want to protect people who can't protect themselves. But there are also principles where you want people to be able to make their own decisions. And you have to weigh those. And I don't think it's necessarily an unethical decision to say that in this particular case, I give the mother more weight than I give, you know, an unviable fetus. You know, I think that's a perfectly ethical decision.
Absolutely, especially since the alternative demands that society stake a claim to her physical self. You really do. You really do, regardless of whatever you think. And I know one of the things that makes it muddy, and it's fascinating, is that the viability of the fetus, of course, does get pushed earlier and earlier because medicine is amazing. But I think that changes the circumstances but doesn't change the ultimate truth that you still can't – she's still not an incubator just because she happened to get pregnant. And yes, maybe she shouldn't have been having unprotected sex or whatever, but again, that's her choice as well. You're allowed to do that. And you're allowed to make mistakes. And freedom is messy. Like, I happen to be pro-gun. I'm liberal about most things, but I'm pro-gun. And I used to be the guy who wanted more gun laws. Because it's true, if we got rid of handguns, we'd save so many lives. But then the thing that I eventually came to was I thought, yeah, we would save a lot of lives. But that's not the point. That's what I think. I'm like, yeah, you'd save lives. Could save lives a lot of ways. Save lives by just locking people up. That would just save a lot of lives. You could save lives by not letting people drive. But unfortunately, freedom is a very dirty business. Freedom is unpleasant in a lot of ways because, you know, you have the right to pursue happiness. You don't have the right to happiness.
True.
That's really the bottom line is that people who are allowed to make decisions are going to make bad ones. Supposed to. I mean, for a little bit of the Jewish perspective, and this is uniquely Jewish because Christians don't really believe this, or some Christians maybe do, but in Judaism, there's a discussion about a rabbi, actually a specific rabbi I'm thinking of, Tovia Singer, was asked, who created evil? He was asked, it's just something, how did evil come about? And he said, God created evil. And that's something that some Christians struggle with the notion, but that's a hallmark of Judaism. Good and bad were created by God. And there's a verse where he says, I have created today good and evil, choose wisely. The whole notion is, yep, you're allowed to choose evil. Because it's your choice of good is meaningless without evil. And that's philosophy for you. But in a practical day-to-day, there's a reason I'm pro-choice, and it's because I think it is the ethical choice. I'll agree with you. I think ethics is better, as far as a way to say it. Yeah.
Yeah, but the point is that we started on, and that we may or may not have roundabout made, is that there is an argument. There's an argument on both sides.
Absolutely.
And that it's a sincere and legitimate argument.
Absolutely.
On both sides. And the problem with this particular issue, regardless of what you believe, is that the conversation is impossible. The conversation is impossible because it's so emotionally charged.
Yeah.
Both ways.
Yeah.
Pro, con, whichever side you believe you're on, or whatever. No, everybody believes what they believe, and they believe it fully, but they believe that the other guy doesn't have a point. And sometimes they believe the other guy's not even sincere. And that's why abortion is such a touchy subject.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an emotionally charged issue to begin with, because you're talking
about life.
You're talking about life. Children. You're talking about pregnancy. You're talking about things that just kind of hit home.
Motherhood.
But the problem is the conversation needs to continue. And nobody's ever going to be satisfied with the outcome, because there's always going to be somebody. There's going to be somebody who thinks that there's unborn lives that need to be protected and doesn't like that it's legal. There's going to be somebody that thinks people's rights are being taken away and doesn't like that it's illegal. So there's really no solution. But that doesn't mean that the conversation should continue, so we understand why we hold the position we hold.
And we can clean up the conversation. Right? Like, a lot of what I want to do on this podcast is consider the notion that we can clean up the conversation.
The conversation needs to become reasonable.
Yeah.
And that's the problem, is that it's completely the conversation about abortion is completely unreasonable right now.
Yeah. And let me introduce something too. I have a dear friend of mine who we have just a wonderful relationship, and one of the first conversations we ever had was about abortion, because we're both loudmouths, and she holds very different views from mine, and it got a little ugly in the beginning, and it took a while. And we found a way to talk to each other respectfully. And she still holds the position she holds, and she votes a lot of times accordingly. She doesn't always vote 100% that way, but she does a lot of times. And I have nothing but the highest regard. We found a way, and if you know, I'm a loudmouth just like anybody else, but we found a way to respectfully, you know, and, you know, she brought up completely valid, what about, you know, teenage girls who want to make their prom and leave a baby in a garbage can, and her argument was that, do you devalue life to the point that that's an option, and that that's one of the consequences of abortion? I'm not sure she's entirely right, but I see her point. But we found a way to talk, and to the point now where I love her, she loves me, we're deeply close, and we still hold polar opposite positions. And if you knew her, she's much easier to get along with. She's just a much nicer person than I am. But she's just, I think, really, one of my objectives throughout the course of the podcast will be to clean up the conversation. Obviously, I think I'm right. But don't have to be right in a cruel way or in a dickish way.
Right, yeah. Everybody thinks they're right. But the problem is when you assume that the other guy isn't also sincere.
Right.
And that the other guy has no point to make.
Exactly.
And that's the problem.
Yeah. I want to go ahead and... thank you, by the way. That's very smart. I want to tangent? I don't think so. I want to go into another topic that's related. Man by the name of it, I want to make sure I wrote it down. Craig Ewart. I might be saying his last name wrong. But on English television, and it's a related topic, but we're going with a much older person. On English television, I read the news that there was a reality program that crossed a line that nobody should cross. And did you read about this?
I did not.
Reality television that showed the man in the moment of his death assisted suicide. And it did, in fact, broadcast in England. And, of course, European TV, if you don't know, they're way ahead of us as far as reality TV. Their reality TV technology is way above ours. There's a guy named Craig Ewert who was terminally ill, and they broadcast the moment of his death through assisted suicide. And I believe it's not actually legal in England, and I believe what he did is he went overseas, is how I understand that what happened was he went overseas and they documented this thing. And it has been raising in Parliament the issue of assisted suicide and legalized assisted suicide again, and I thought that would be an interesting topic to touch on a little bit before we wrap up. The two things that I want to say, I found out later, it wasn't a reality program, it was a documentary. And there is a distinction, but in the first article that I read, they called it a reality show. And which I imagined, because they call it a reality show, that it was like, oh, I didn't get a rose, so I'm going to take the poison. It's such a diminishing word.
Yeah, the connotation show is much more exploitative.
Yeah. And whereas this was a guy who was documenting his experience through a crew, but apparently it was his idea to document the experience.
And presumably to raise awareness of the issue.
Exactly, to raise awareness of the issue. And, you know, his wife was there with him and was supporting him. And they did broadcast. I mean, you can still question whether or not it's appropriate to show somebody in the moments when they die. But, you know, if they died of natural causes and they showed it on TV, it probably wouldn't be a big deal necessarily. If it was just like, this is inspirational Bob, and Bob has cancer, and he's not long for this world, and he's got his final words, and we saw him die, it would probably be tastefully cut away from, but we'd still probably show it. What, of course, raised a lot of people's ire was the fact that this was assisted suicide. Not surprisingly, I'm pro-legalized assisted suicide. I'm not quite sure. Can you explain to me the religious objection, because I don't entirely understand it.
Well, I'm no...
And obviously you're doing it from an intellectual standpoint, not from an... But that's what we do.
I think that the objection is just the same. It's the sanctity of life argument. It's the... we don't have the right to choose when our lives end. That's supposed to be out of our hands. That's supposed to be God's decision, if you will.
Right.
It's the same argument against suicide in general.
Yeah. Although it's interesting, suicide's not actually illegal. Attempted suicide is. I always find that funny, because it's a funny distinction.
Has been illegal.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I thought they always drew the distinction on...
No, I'm pretty sure that suicide... I don't know if it still is. I'm sure there are probably locales where it still is. But yes, there have been places and times when suicide is illegal. I think maybe people just kind of figured out that was insensitive.
Yeah.
And kind of counterproductive, but...
Yeah, and who do you prosecute?
Well, survivors.
Did they do that?
I don't know if that's ever been done.
But you could.
Yeah.
Wow, that's interesting.
You can see how that would be completely unhelpful.
Yeah.
So.
Boy, how depressed would you be after that?
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, I'm not going to make the obvious bad joke.
But, yeah.
For once.
Thank you.
But I think the basic argument is just, it's the sanctity of life argument. That we don't have the right to make that choice.
You know, it's interesting because one of the things that will happen in hospitals, of course, is that they do wink-wink assisted suicides.
Right.
Where it's basically like, wow, here's your pain medication, and it's just kind of possible for you to put in a little too much. And I think it's unfortunate we put doctors in that position, because I think there's a lot of us in society who are just lack balls. Because it seems to me that most people actually agree with the notion that somebody who's terminally ill has a right to end it a little early. But is it that people are afraid of the slippery slope?
I don't know if people necessarily do agree with that notion, although I think that people who are forced to confront it may end up agreeing with it.
Right.
I mean, I think people who are away from it at a distance may not believe in that, but when you're living it, when you're suffering constantly or seeing someone you love suffering constantly, I think maybe that experience changes a lot of people's minds.
And there is no end, too. Like, you know, there's one thing to say when you're suicidal because you're depressed and you don't see that things could change. Well, things could change, but of course, in this circumstance, well, no, things can't.
Right.
You know, time is not on your side. You know, maybe research in 50 years will save you, but you've got 6 months. So, yeah, there was a related case where somebody was, and I guess they documented this as well. I don't think they showed this, where somebody was killed, assisted suicide because of quality of life. What are your thoughts? What are your personal thoughts on that? Assisted suicide for quality of life.
My personal thoughts?
Yeah.
I don't know that it's a choice that I could make. It's a choice I would not, I don't see myself making, but I can respect.
Yeah.
Someone else, I can respect that someone else's experience may be different enough that they may make that choice.
So from a law standpoint, you could see the validity of it being legal.
Yeah, obviously that's an issue where people would be
scared of a
slippery slope kind of situation, a quality of life. And obviously that's not, I don't know, it's hard to define quality of life. Yeah, but there are conditions that are so severe that you're effectively just surviving. You're not really getting anything else.
Yeah.
You can't really do or accomplish anything. I can see someone making an informed, assuming they're capable of making an informed decision,
I think that's the part of the slippery slope there that I do agree is difficult, is like, are they impaired to the point where they can't say? And then if they can't say, but then that all goes down to medical consent anyway. So I don't even know if that seems more tricky than it probably is.
Yeah, I certainly it's an uncomfortable subject. It's a complicated subject. But this is the reason why we have ethics committees. This is the reason why we have review boards for cases that can't be decided like lightly.
Yeah,
you know. So I don't see any particular reason why there can't be a process in place. Why, if someone says, I feel that my quality of life has deteriorated so severely, I don't see a point in going on. Why that case can't be reviewed by medical professionals who can say there's no they can review all the facts of the case and say there's no chance for this to improve, for this guy's condition to improve.
It can only get worse whatever.
If he wants to make this informed, and we believe he's capable of making an informed decision, or she is capable of making an informed decision.
No, I don't think women should be allowed to do that.
We believe that this is a good decision, or to say, you know, we believe that this guy's not thinking clearly. We believe that there's hope for this guy's condition to improve. We don't recommend this.
Yeah.
You know, I think there can be an ethical and reasonable process. It's obviously not something that should be taken lightly, but I think it's something that can be approached rationally.
Yeah. I'll share a quick story about suicide. I find suicide fascinating. I think a lot of people probably do. I think I probably have an unhealthy fascination with it. Part of which is that one of my brothers killed himself. I've, for whatever reason, known a number of people who've killed themselves, and it's been, you know, I have an emotional connection in some levels, but then I also have an intellectual detachment that I've always had with a lot of things, where I tend to analyze things and I think about them. When I was in college, I had this psychology teacher, and she was a great teacher, and it was a great class, and she was the kind of teacher who would use personal examples to illustrate whatever. And it turns out she had a son who suffered from depression, and he had killed himself. And he had taken a number of medications over the years. And one of the things she said about suicide was, she said, if you knew somebody who had cancer, and they went through chemotherapy, and they went through various treatments, but ultimately they died, what you would say is that the disease ran its course. And what she said of her son was, her perspective was, he took the medications, a lot of them didn't work for him, he struggled. Her perspective was that the disease, depression, had run its course. And I think one of the things that would help in considering assisted suicide and also just kind of coming to terms with it, it's the same thing as unmuddying it with emotion. Emotions are important, and I don't want to say that we shouldn't have them, but more like trying to understand it from an intellectual point of view as well, and what it really means to individuals, I guess, is what I'm kind of saying. And that when I see a guy who's got leukemia and he's not going to get any better, and he says, yeah, that's enough for me, I think that's a pretty good, fair thing for him to decide to do. Recognizing, of course, that if you believe in God and you believe that your particular God is going to damn him to hell for checking out 2 months early, I understand your objection, and I respect that. I don't share it, but I understand it.
Yeah, but it also comes back to, again, respecting his experience and his choice.
His freedom, his choice,
his freedom,
yeah.
His choice. It's supposed to be his choice.
Because he doesn't share your religious view, clearly. Yeah. And even if he did, he's decided it's trumped by his pain. It's trumped by his suffering. Well, it's been a fun show, I'll say that. Any other thoughts on those particular topics? Anything, even just tangential?
Obviously, they're both difficult topics, and I don't think anybody takes them lightly, which makes it disappointing that in many ways the conversation is treated lightly.
Yeah. Now that's a great point. As serious as the topic is, and then how like hands off the topic is, right?
Yeah, and just the like we were saying, where people approach it as if they have the only viable, or the only worthwhile point of view on the topic, and it's very dismissive and disrespectful.
I agree with that. I agree with that. And also, again, and I'll say this a lot in this, but like when I mentioned the Bible early, one of the things I hold people who believe in a holy book to a higher standard than I hold other people. And the reason I hold people to a higher standard is because they say they deserve to be held to a higher standard. Because if you say that your book is the book that represents the Word of God, and you are speaking for God in essence, I hold you to a higher standard because you've demanded that from me. You know?
Oh, that you have reminded me of one other point, and unfortunately, I don't think we have enough time to really get into this again. I don't want to start another conversation, but We've approached it mostly as an ethical issue, but speaking from a legal standpoint, my religion says no abortion isn't necessarily a good basis for law. It's still an incomplete argument for why it should be illegal.
Right.
So you still, it's fine if you want to say, I don't believe abortion is ethical, I don't believe abortion is moral. That's a perfectly valid position to stake out. That still doesn't explain why it should be illegal.
Right.
So that's still an incomplete argument. But unfortunately, I think we're past the point of discussing that. But
yeah, let's pick that up in another episode, because that's actually, even just outside of abortion, that goes,
it applies to a lot of things.
Yeah. Yeah, it really does.
You know, there's the old Mr. Show sketch where someone declares something and somebody else asks him why, and he goes, because the Bible? And because the Bible is just not a very convincing argument unless you already believe in the Bible.
Yeah. And if you already believed in it, you'd already be adhering to the rule. So there's a nice, nice little circle that goes along with that.
Yeah.
All right, Tommy. Thank you very much. Thanks for everybody who's listening. And we'll listen. We'll talk at you next time. If you'd like to contact Tom or myself with any comments about the show, we would love to hear from you. Please do so at our MySpace page or at Facebook. Thanks a lot, and thanks for listening to Stealing God. Of the King of
the king of TV. I am the king of TV. That's me, king of TV.